From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's show, how a skilled magician turns his talents at sleight of hand to cheating in a high-stakes private poker game. Derek Del Gaudio is a writer, performer, and artist whose one-man live show, in and of itself, is now a movie directed by Frank Oz, available on Hulu. His new memoir, A Moral Man, recalls a time in his 20s when he accepts the offer of a veteran card shark to become a dealer at a Texas Hold'em poker game in Beverly Hills, where his job is to cheat most other players out of their money. His memoir, like his live show, explores themes of identity and honesty and the emotional cost of keeping secrets. Also, John Powers reviews the latest book from Mick Herron, who John says is the best spy novelist writing today. Our guest today, Derek Del Gaudio, has a career that's, well, a little hard to describe. He's a writer, performer, artist, and though he doesn't exactly think of himself as a magician, he's skilled in the arts of illusion and has three times won Magician of the Year awards from the Academy of Magical Arts. He has a new memoir in which he describes a time in his life when he had another identity, a card cheat. He was the well-paid dealer in a private poker game, where his job was to use his card-handling skills to take most of the players' money. He describes techniques he used and what it felt like to deceive people at a table where the stakes could be deadly if a player caught on to his game. Derek Del Gaudio is perhaps best known for a live show he performed for 2.5 years in Los Angeles and New York, directed by Frank Oz, called In and of Itself. It's now a movie, also directed by Frank Oz, which is available on Hulu. His new memoir is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. He joins me from his home in New York City. Derek Del Gaudio, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start by talking a little bit about, being a card shark, a card mechanic, I think you call him. You were dealing at this private poker game, and you had a job. I mean, it wasn't on the level, and you had to make sure the right guy won. This wasn't a simple matter of getting one lucky card to the guy you wanted to win, right?
Yeah, I mean, you need to be able to use the actions at the table to achieve the effects you want to achieve. So, you know, through shuffles and deals, you need to be able to manipulate the cards and put them in perhaps orders that you want, or not deal a card to someone that you don't want them to get. And so, yeah, you just need to have a large toolbox full of these things and, you know, sort of play it like jazz, where depending on what moment in the game you're at, you use the right tool for the right job.
Right. And it's like you're not just getting a good hand to the guy you want to win. You got to get an almost good hand to the guy that you want to get in and lose, right?
Certainly. I mean, it doesn't do any good if you give your partner a great hand and no one else has a hand at the table for them to bet. They need something to feel like they have skin in the game. So you need to make sure that if your guy has something good, it needs to be just slightly better than whatever else someone else has.
You want to just share, I don't know how, if you can do this without being too technical, but some of the moves that you would use to get cards where you wanted them?
I don't know that there's any way to describe it without getting too technical, other than through shuffling, you're able to place cards in specific positions that you want, or you have a prearranged deck and you maintain the order of that deck through a series of simulated shuffles and cuts.
Right. There's a moment you describe where you have what they call a cold deck, right? That's a deck that was prearranged in a certain order. And somehow in the middle of the game, while you're at the center of all this attention, you somehow get the old deck out and the new deck in, right?
Yeah, you exchange one deck for another, and then the new deck that's on the table is prearranged so that your partner wins and the other people at the table lose.
You once had a cold deck in your sock, and you had to get it from your sock into your hands.
Yeah, they didn't allow me to have pockets at the table because none of the dealers who dealt in this house had pockets. They all had to sew their pockets shut so they wouldn't steal chips. And because I was dressed like other dealers, I didn't have any pockets. And so I found myself in a moment of panic having to figure out a place to put this extra deck. And my sock was the only place I could think of.
You would sometimes deal from the second card in the deck. That's called seconds, right? Wow, that's just amazing. And nobody can tell. It looks like you're grabbing the top card, but you're always getting exactly the second card, not the third, not the fourth.
Yeah, it's creating that. It's just, you know, an illusion. You create the illusion that the top card is coming off, but really you're reaching down underneath and grabbing the second card. And that's, you know, something I spent thousands of hours in my bedroom practicing.
I mean, having the skill with your hands obviously is critical, but you've also got to do this and seem relaxed, right? You're just doing what any other dealer does at a table, right?
Yeah, that's the hard part, is hiding the technique, making it so that the effort is invisible and so that it all seems natural and there can't ever be a moment of hesitation or thinking, or at least an appearance of hesitation or thinking.
If you look like you're being furtive, then it sends the wrong signal. Would you ever try to distract players so they wouldn't see you make a critical move? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the distraction might be.
No, I certainly wouldn't, because that would draw attention to myself. You know, if I were causing a distraction and trying to achieve a move at the same time, it would kind of defeat the purpose, because I'm trying to get them to not look at me. So I would exploit distractions that occurred, though. So if something happened at the table, someone were to order a drink, or two players were to get into an argument or things like that, it is an opportune moment to exploit the game.
This is interesting to read in the book. Some players would literally stare at your hands, right?
Sure. It's natural for people who've been playing cards for hours to not have anywhere else to look other than the person who's in front of them about to deal their next hand. And it became something that you just had to cope with and learn that they're not necessarily staring at your hands because they think you're cheating. They're staring at your hands because they're waiting for their next card. They're bored, or they're a gambler, and they just want to see what's going to happen next. I'm sure there are people who stare because they want to make sure that the dealer is on the up and up, but more often than not, they're just staring because they don't have anything else to look at.
Yeah, and that's the next fix, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's talk about your life as you describe it in this book. You grew up without a father. What do you know of the circumstances of your birth?
Very little. I know my mother was 17 years old, and she raised me basically by herself until I was about 6 years old when she finally met someone. But I only know what she told me, and it's not much.
So you never met your dad at all?
When I was older, I had the opportunity, but it didn't work out.
There's a big moment that you describe in the book when you were 6 years old. You want to share that with us?
Yeah, when I was six, I walked in on my mother kissing a woman and learned that she was gay. And that was a pivotal moment, because that was also the night that I learned that I would never have a father. You know, growing up, expecting my mother to find a nice man. And she actually dated a few guys that I remember. And so I thought for a moment there that I was going to get a father. But then I learned that it wasn't in the cards, so to speak.
I mean, seeing your mom kissing a woman was maybe, well, I don't know, disorienting, whatever. Do you recall the conversations that she had with you about this and what it meant?
Yeah, vividly. She had taught me the word gay before that moment. Preparing me for I guess the conversation she knew we would inevitably have. I was the last to know, basically, because once she realized that she was gay, I mean, she was only, I guess, 22 or 3 at the time, so she was very young. When she realized she was gay, she immediately told all the people around her, but I was kind of the last to know. She didn't really know how to tell me, but she prepared me for the conversation, taught me what the word was, normalized it, and when I ostensibly caught her, she had the honest conversation with me that she was gay, and that didn't change anything, but didn't, and she you know, didn't mean she loved me any less, and still loved me more than anything, and I was heartbroken, not because she was gay. I didn't see anything wrong with being gay, but because it was the night I learned I would never have a father.
I have to say, your mom sounds like a pretty remarkable person.
She is.
Yeah, very positive energy. She got herself through school, and she had a really tough family life, it sounds like, when she was growing up, and then trained to become a firefighter, right?
Yeah, she did. I don't know really how she did it being a single parent, but she grew up kind of with a hard family life. Her mother and father didn't get along. There was a lot of anger and hostility and violence in the household, and she kind of grew up with her, you know, her and her sisters took care of each other, And then she had me, and her life got kind of turned upside down. And she somehow managed to go on to become an EMT and then a firefighter, which was her dream. And she made that happen.
You lived in Colorado in a pretty conservative community. How did having a gay mom affect your life there?
I mean, it was daily. I remember feeling I didn't feel otherness, that my family or my household was different until I really sort of kind of became part of the community that I was in and started making friends with the neighbors and things like that. And then I could tell that we were different because it was explicitly not okay to be gay in the neighborhoods that I was around. And so that became a secret for me. And I kept that from the world, basically, because it felt like life or death when I could see the hostility in my neighborhood and people were literally saying, like, we don't want you here. Learning to keep that to myself felt necessary.
And did carrying that secret meant that you just didn't want to get close to friends? Did it make you a loner?
I would say it probably did. Yeah, because I mean, it definitely did. I didn't. If you don't know who you can trust in terms of, if you're not able to reveal a form of love to someone, or that a form of love exists to someone, and have it bite you in the ass, how can you reveal anything? Like, love should be the one thing that you're at least safe to talk about. And I talked about my family and the love that's in it, and it was destructive. And so I learned to basically keep my mouth shut and only trust those who I knew could be trusted.
You had this difficulty in your life where people around you didn't accept the fact that your mom was gay, and in partly because of that, I guess you never really connected with school and friends. But you did find another passion that would be life-changing. How did this happen?
My mom played a practical joke on me. It was a cap gun, like the way that a cap gun fires a cap. It's that without the gun. So it's just this little spring contraption, like a mouse trap that you put under a soda can. And so when you pick up the can off the counter, it makes a huge bang. And so she played this joke on me, and I reached for a Coke on the counter, and it exploded, and it was very amusing. And I was 12 years old, and I just thought it was great. And I asked my mother where she got it, and she said it was at a joke store that they had near her work. Now, her work was 80 miles away in Colorado Springs. We lived in Littleton at the time, so getting there was difficult because she worked at the firehouse, and her schedule was odd and 24 hours on and then 24 hours off and then on and off. And so getting me out there to the joke shop was challenging. So it took a while, but eventually I had a dentist appointment, and I could only see the dentist in the city she worked in. So we took a road trip 80 miles to the dentist. And the one thing that I was excited about was going to this joke shop. And I went into the joke shop, and it was this miraculous place with, you know, feather boas and giant glasses and the arrow through head that I saw Steve Martin wear on TV and rubber chickens and things like that. And I looked around and filled a little basket full of, itching powder and little things you put in people's cigars to make them explode. It's kind of like, you know, Bugs Bunny's dream, this place. And then the guy behind the counter asked me if I would take a look at something for him, and he showed me an old, beat-up old pocket knife, and he transformed it into a beautiful pocket knife and then made the pocket knife vanish. And it was baffling, and I didn't understand what was happening. And it was about the time I realized it wasn't a joke shop, it was a magic shop. And I wanted to learn what I had just witnessed, and the part that I was interested in was sleight of hand. There were lots of gadgets and gizmos you could buy and things, you know, for birthday party magicians to do at kids' shows and things like that. But I was really the sleight of hand that I was drawn to. And he sold me a book. And so I didn't end up getting any of the jokes. I had to spend all the money I had saved up mowing lawns on this book. And so I bought a book on sleight of hand and I took it home with me. And I learned everything in it. And that was apparently very unusual for a kid that age to be so enamored with and devoted to learning from a dense textbook like this. But I was just drawn to it. And I really there's something about it that inspired me and fueled me.
The owner of the shop, Walter, became a real force in your life, right? I mean, you spent a lot of time there and did more books and videotapes and practice at school and all the time. Did you ever want to perform, impress your friends, you know?
No, that was kind of the peculiar thing, is I really was reluctant to perform. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't want to do it. I didn't seek it out, which most of the people who get interested in magic and illusions and sleight of hand, that's why they do it. They do it as a means to an end. They want to end up in front of people doing these things for people. For me, sleight of hand was the end. That was sleight of hand and illusions and understanding them and practicing them was enough for me. I didn't need to take that next step to perform. And in fact, I avoided it.
You know, it's interesting. You describe a couple of occasions where, you know, you got good with your hands of, you know, hiding the ball and making the coin disappear and, you know, the balls under the cups and all. And both in a little demonstration to your mom and to a customer at the store, because you started working at the store and Walter said, hey, let's engage these people. You kind of had the moves down. You made the stuff disappear, but both people noticed there was something that was sort of undermining the effectiveness of, you know, the illusion. What was it?
I didn't know how to carry the burden of a secret. I was allowing secrecy to affect my performance. I assume that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, this is fascinating because that's a theme that runs through your childhood, and yeah.
Yeah, it's secrets are, as I say in the book, they're like a drug, and they enter your system and they intoxicate you and they get you to modify your behavior whether you know it or not. And so it's learning to control the effects of secrecy that really were key for me in terms of making creating a convincing illusion. Because if you it's one thing to pretend to put a coin in your hand and make it seem like it vanishes, but there's so much involved with even that simple act of pretending to put a coin from one hand to the other so that you can show that it's appears to have disappeared. Really, the guilt, in a sense, that goes with that, with deceiving someone else, you can feel it in your body, and it takes over, in a sense, and it manifests in ways that you might not expect. It might affect it certainly affects your movements, it affects your speech pattern, it can affect your breathing, can affect your heart rate, it can affect every part of your body.
So how would it undermine your tricks? I mean,
well, for me, like I was, you know, scolded by mentors and things for maybe moving too quickly the phrase was don't run if they're not chasing you. And there's this tendency of when you're hiding something from someone, when you're concealing something from them, parts of you, whether it's physically or emotionally or intellectually, parts of you start to retreat. And because you're afraid of getting caught by them. And so it's learning to not run and to just stand there as comfortably as possible, even though you are concealing something from them. Learning that is key in creating a convincing illusion of naturalness.
All right. So if you're utterly cynical, you feel no guilt for your secrets. Your hands will move with this nice fluid ease like nothing else is happening, and it's convincing.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, you see it in politics today. You see the people who are comfortable with the lies that they tell versus the people who are not quite as comfortable, and they maybe you can tell that they're carrying this weight with them as opposed to letting it roll right off their back. I mean, it's true for everything.
Wow, a lot of that going around these days. Do you observe that?
Yeah.
who do you see that's giving us a tell?
Yeah. I mean, it's the reason. Yeah, it's part of the reason I wrote the book was because all of these things I grew up with are so prevalent in our everyday lives now. We see people knowingly deceive us, and there's both the implicit deceptions where we're not able to prove it, but we know that we're being deceived. But then there's also the explicit ones where people are just flat out lying to our faces, and we recognize it. And that's, I think, part of the reason I felt like this was worth telling this story now.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Derek Delgaudio. His new memoir is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Western Governors University. Want a quality college education, but worried about the cost? At WGU, you can earn a respected bachelor's or master's degree for under $8,700 per year, fees included. WGU's low, flat rate tuition covers as many courses as you can complete each term. That means the faster you learn, the more you'll save. Listeners of this podcast can have the $65 application fee waived. Learn more at wgu.edu/freshair.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with writer, artist, performer, and magician Derek Delgaudio. You can see the movie based on his stage show, In and of Itself, directed by Frank Oz, on Hulu. His memoir about growing up, learning magic, and for a time, earning a living as a card shark is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. So you, as a teenager, got to spending a lot of time in this magic shop owned by this man, Walter, and you learned from his books and his tapes, and you learned from professional magicians that he knew. And eventually you wanted to meet somebody who wasn't a magician, but somebody who made a living hustling with cards. How are these people and their world different from that of performing magicians?
The stakes for card sharks or card mechanics are very different than the stakes for a magician in that they're working in the real world, not a theatrical world. You know, if a magician messes up, they just don't get applause. But if a card cheat messes up, who knows what can happen? Could just be that he's sent on his way. It could be much worse. And their intentions are different. Magicians broadcast their secrecy. Even when they're concealing something from you, they want you to know that they're concealing something from you. That's part of where they get recognition for their talents, is that they know more than you about a thing. And they want you to know that because that's what this is about. It's about a demonstration of power, in a sense. And cheats are the opposite. They need to conceal everything, including especially the secret, and they can't broadcast their secrecy at all. They must contain all of it, and it must appear as if nothing is happening, and other than what should be happening. So you can see it in the hands of a magician. A magician, adds an extra flourish, or there's an elegance to maybe the way he handles a deck of cards and a fluidity, where a card cheat might be sloppy and might seem immature with the way that they hold cards, or rough, or, like they might grab it like they'd grab an axe. There's nothing dainty or elegant about it. And so they just have different approaches. And I became obsessed with sleight of hand, and I gravitated towards what would be considered the more difficult sleights, because I think it was what got the attention of the people I admired. They liked seeing a young kid do things that they maybe had never seen anyone do. And so the harder the move, the more eager I was to learn it. And the hardest moves that I had come across were the moves from the gambling world. And these are things like bottom deals and false shuffles and run-up shuffles and tabled pharaohs and second deals and just the moves that are almost mythical in terms of magicians sort of maybe can do them or have heard of them, but they have never really done them or seen them done the way they should be done. And so I wanted to learn those things.
The best of the best. Wow.
Those moves are considered the most difficult. I don't know if that's actually true. I mean, there's difficult moves in all branches of sleight of hand, but what makes them exceedingly difficult is how they have to simulate real life in such a way that it must look exactly like what it represents. So if we're talking about false deals, which is like what I did at the card table, it can't look like you maybe took a card off the top. It has to look like you took a card off the top every single time. And as opposed to in Magic, it's okay if oh, maybe he did something. The maybe he did something is often the point of Magic. Maybe he snuck the ball under the cup. I didn't see it, but I felt it. That feeling of maybe he did something is often encouraged in Magic shows where it's a game of cat and mouse and can you catch me or not. That doesn't exist in the gambling world. There's no performativity of the hands. There's no performativity of the mannerism. It all has to live as a simulation of real.
So your friend at the Magic shop, Walt, connects you with a guy named Ronnie, and you meet him at a pool hall in Denver. You have to take a bus. You're, what are you, 17 maybe at the time or something?
17, yeah.
And he wants to see you do something to prove that you're, you know, you got some game, and you do. And a friendship develops. You end up driving with him from Colorado to Knoxville. He doesn't fly, so he's going to go there. You want to just tell us a little about him and what you learn hanging with him?
Yeah, I mean, Ronnie is several people to me. He's a card mechanic, a grifter of sorts, and you know, one of the last real card mechanics in the country, and people who actually do these moves, the sleight of hand, the bottom deals, and false shuffles, and table hops, and things like that. These are things that aren't usually done now, or haven't been done in years, because when most people think of card cheats, they're thinking of someone from, you know, 50, 100 years ago, the cowboy who saddles up to the table and deals off the bottom of the deck. That hasn't existed for quite some time, because why would you do that when you could, you know, develop some sort of advanced, you know, camera system with marked cards and electronics that allow you to just devastate a game with very little practice, relatively speaking. So those types of card sharps or sleight of hand experts didn't really exist when I was coming around in the late 90s. And so I really had to search for those guys because I really wanted to see it done live and in person. And so there weren't a few. And one of those guys was passing through town in Denver, and I had moved to Colorado Springs at this point. So I had to figure out how to get to Denver and meet this guy who a friend of mine arranged a meeting between us. And I didn't think anything of it. This was my world. It was sleight of hand. And my mother had met several people who had mentored me. And it was a way to keep me out of trouble, ironically. Like, you know, meeting a card cheat seemed less problematic than, you know, hanging out with people my own age in a town riddled with meth. It seemed like the better bet.
There's a point where you're on this road trip and you're at a barbecue joint, and you kind of joke to Ronnie that maybe you might want to get into the business. And then he gives you a pretty stern message. What does he do?
Yeah, I brought up the topic of me playing in a game like the games that Ronnie had played in, and it was very clear from the beginning of our relationship that I was not going to use the things that I was doing or learning in card games. Ronnie would never have probably taught me anything or give me the time of day if he thought I was doing it to enter the world that he was living in. He just, you know, met a young kid who was interested in what he did in a technical sense, and I really did admire his virtuosity. And so it was kind of an unwritten agreement between us that he would teach me things as long as I was only going to use it for good. And then one day I kind of crossed that line, and I asked him, well, what if I did do what you did? What if I did try to play in a game? What do you think about that? And his answer was showing me the scars on his back that he had never shown me before. He was playing in a game and was taken out back afterwards or confronted after the game and stabbed a few times with a pocket knife and left for dead. And I didn't know that part of him because he had been concealing that part of his life and who he was from me. And so it was kind of a wake-up call, really. And it was a world he had been concealing from me.
Yeah. You don't want this life, kid, in other words, was the message. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We're speaking with Derek Del Gaudio. His new memoir is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. You can see the film based on his stage show, in and of itself, on Hulu. We'll be back to talk more after a short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Sattva, the comfort company. Sattva luxury mattresses are made in America by expert craftsmen using the highest quality materials so that your mattress will provide comfortable sleep for years and years. Sattva mattresses are always delivered to your home and set up in the room of your choice. They're never folded and never squeezed into a small box. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR, where NPR listeners save an additional $225. Sattva, the comfort company.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
So you sought other employment. You take us to a point where you're 25 years old and you're living with Vanessa, who's now your wife, right? Vanessa Lauren. And she's employed. You're kind of underemployed trying to find jobs and not quite sure what to do. And then you get a call from Ronnie, the old card player from way back. And he has, well, he has a need and a proposition. What does he tell you?
Yeah, Ronnie had gotten in trouble with the law for violating a probation that he had been on for getting in trouble with the law earlier. And he needed some help. He had been dealing in a private poker game in Beverly Hills. And he asked if I would sub for him. I would go in as his substitution until he got out of the jail. And he didn't want to call me. He didn't want to even ask me, but I was kind of the only person who geographically and perhaps physically could do what was required at this game.
Yeah, and had the skills. I mean, he knew you had the skills. You're reluctant. You say, I'm not so sure. He says, well, go talk to them. So while Ronnie's doing time for his probation, parole violation, you end up going there and to this mansion, and there's this poker game, and you end up agreeing to do it. You want to just describe the place, the setup, the players?
Yeah, it's a fancy house in the hills. It's where those tour buses in Hollywood drive around and they point to celebrities' houses for the tourists to take pictures of. It was a house like that behind a big wall. And inside it was, you know, decorated not for living but for setting a tone, which is of money and of lifestyle, basically. It's like a Pinterest house. They had fake artwork on the walls and big leather couches for people to sit in, and it was built for comfort so that people would come and feel cozy and stay. When the games were going on, there was a chef in the kitchen who would make whatever players wanted to eat, and there were beautiful women who would serve the drinks, and they even had a masseuse from time to time to come rub the shoulders of people after sitting at the table for so long. So it was just a nice house with nice environment inside.
Right, and the players would come. They would learn by word of mouth. What was the minimum, stake that a player had to put up to get in the game?
$10,000 to buy in.
Okay.
And but it was no limit, so they could lose as much as they'd like.
Right. So there's this whole operation, and Leo is the guy that runs it, and his son Max, and they're going to get all the money. And the fascinating thing is all these players, there are chefs and waiters and legitimate dealers who have no idea what the real business plan is, and even a legitimate guy who thinks he's the boss, they're all kind of part of a game that they don't really understand, right? Your job is to get in there as dealer on occasion and steer everything the right way.
Correct. I was hired as what's known as a bust-out dealer. Technically, bust-out dealer is a term used for blackjack, but it's the same thing in this context, where there was a poker game and there were other professional poker dealers who were hired to deal this game, and I was hired also, and I had to dress like them, wear the same, black pants, white shirt, same uniform. But when I was there, I steered the game and controlled the narrative of it to help the people who hired me win.
So you go in, and the first night, you think you're just going to do some regular dealing for a while, but Leo, your boss, he wants you to get in there and start fixing this right away. What was it like?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is these things happen in steps. You know, I only said yes to agree to meet with the people that employed Ronnie because he asked me to, and he's a friend, and I knew it was easier to say no to his employer than it was to him. So I said yes to Ronnie so I could say no to his boss. But then his boss told me that I didn't have to necessarily cheat on the first game. All I had to do was just come deal. So for me, the idea of just dealing in a poker game for a night didn't seem like that tough of a job and something I could write off as an experience. So I thought the first night was just me practicing and learning to become basically a professional dealer. And by the end of that night, he thought I was doing so well, he encouraged me to cheat. And so I found myself in a position of having to make a moral decision on a night where I thought I was just going to have to be a dealer in a poker game.
And what was that experience like?
Out of body? Perhaps. It was tough because it was all physical and mental, in the sense of I trained a large portion of my life to physically do these things. And I had wondered if I had what it takes. Could I do these things? Because you mythologize them. These people who go in games and sit down and do these things, and you wonder, like, wow, if I watched The Sting like it was a documentary, you know, and think like, oh, could I sit at a table and do these things? Like if push came to shove. And so, you know, you wonder if you're capable of these things. And now I found myself literally, you know, sitting at the table trying to, you know, at the moment of, are you capable of doing these things? And I found myself at a ledge, and I took the leap.
How did Vanessa, your girlfriend, feel about it?
She was conflicted because on the one hand, she knew I was doing this really to help a friend, or at least that's the narrative that I told myself at the beginning. But, you know, she wanted to support me in finding out who I was and what I'm to do here. But also there was concerns, you know, of coming home safely. And it was temporary. The only reason there was any sort of I think, approval is not even the right word, but tolerance of it, is because it was a temporary thing. It was just do this a little to help a friend. But then as it went on, it became more of a concern of, is this what you do now?
Let's go around the table and look at some of these characters. I mean, there's Leo, the guy who's the boss running all this. And then there's his son, Max, who, and you got to let him win some because Leo can't win every hand. That would look fishy. Then a lot of them are guys that they refer to as donks. Who are the donks?
The donks are the suckers. The donks are the people, donks, which is short for donkey, which is, of course, jackass. The donks are the suckers who came to that house. And so that was everyone that they were trying to take money from.
Who thought they were at a regular game and weren't. And then there were guys that you refer to as Honest Johns. This is interesting. Maybe one per game, right?
Yeah, the Honest John was really fascinating. The Honest John was someone that the boss hired to sit and win so that I could deal to them, so that they could be the big winner. Because obviously if the same person won, like if Max or Leo won every night, like you said, that would look suspicious. So they always, not always, but they would rotate in what they'd call an Honest John, which was the guy determined to be the big winner that night. But they didn't know that they were part of a crooked game. These were poker players, some of them very prominent poker players, who just thought that they were sitting in to play a poker game. It's not uncommon for a good poker player to be backed by someone. And, you know, say you get to play, here's $10,000, $50,000, go play in this poker game, you get to keep 20% of whatever you win.
This came to an end quite suddenly. I mean, your friend Ronnie had gotten out of jail, was going to come back, but they wanted you to both stay as dealers. And you decided in a flash to get out. Why?
I had a moment of clarity. It was never a life that I had thought that I would end up in. Realistically, it was always like a fanciful thought of I had romanticized that idea of that life in my head, as movies would allow us to do. But I had a moment of real life when a man who I had met at the table before, a player, had just lost all his money, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out his last $5 bill and gave it to me as a tip, which was very common for people to tip me, but usually they tip me with poker chips. And it was something about that moment where I saw the humanity of what was happening, or the lack of humanity of what was happening inside of that house, that was sort of was a moment of awakening, and that there are real people at the other end of these acts, and they're being deceived in such an explicit way that's even beyond deception. These people aren't, they were living fictions as though they were truths. And it was a big realization that I was a part of this deception in a way that was much bigger than I had really thought about. It was such a striking moment that I decided to just never go back.
I have to ask you, do you still practice with cards?
I don't. I haven't touched cards since I stopped doing the show.
All right. Do you want to maintain that skill?
I don't know. I mean, if it helps me tell a story or do something I want to do in the future, I'm sure I'll pick it up again. But until then, I've spent more time with cards than I have with other people. So I think it's okay that I take a break.
Fair enough. Well, Derek Del Gaudio, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Derek Del Gaudio's new memoir is A Moral Man, A True Story and Other Lies. You can see the film based on his stage show, In and of Itself, on Hulu. Coming up, John Powers reviews the latest book from Mick Herron, who John says is the best spy novelist writing today. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
The new novel Slough House by Mick Herron is the seventh installment in his series about a team of bungling British spies who've been put out to pasture but keep getting involved in huge cases anyway. Our critic-at-large John Powers says the book confirms Herron's stature as the best spy novelist now working.
There are scads of talented spy novelists, but the ones who matter capture something essential about their historical moment. Back in the 1930s and 40s, Eric Ambler nailed the sense of ordinary people being caught up in the machinations of great totalitarian powers. A few decades later, John le Carré caught the personal and moral ambiguities of what John F. Kennedy dubbed the long twilight struggle of the Cold War. The spy writer most attuned to our delirious moment is Mick Herron. A British novelist whose funny, brilliantly plotted Slough House books are currently being turned into an Apple TV Plus series starring Gary Oldman. These novels boast an irresistible premise. They follow the adventures of a group of maladroit MI5 agents who've somehow blown it. You know, left a disc marked top secret on the underground, or slept with an ambassador's spouse. But instead of being fired, these slow horses, as they're known, have been shunted off to a rundown London building known as Slough House. There, they do suffocatingly dull tasks under the scornful eye of one-time master spy Jackson Lamb, a repulsive genius who tirelessly and hilariously insults them, punctuating his abuse with farts. Yet even as HQ tries to keep the slow horses hidden away, they somehow always wind up in the middle of the action. It happens again in the series' terrific seventh installment, titled Slough House, just published by Soho Crime. This time out, someone has been killing off Slough House alumni and is now coming for the current crop. But why? The answer lies somewhere in an intelligence snafu that involves the ruthless head of MI5, Diana Taverner, a shambling but ambitious Boris Johnson-like politico, an online media mogul who cares more about making money than broadcasting truth, and that nice man in Russia, Vladimir Putin. Now, if you've read the earlier Slough House novels, and if not, I urge you to start at the beginning with Slow Horses, you'll know that Herron tells his stories with extraordinary verve. He juggles multiple plot lines and reveals character in sharp, sardonic strokes, like this line about the Boris Johnson figure. Achievement in other people was not something he admired. It was like watching someone else walk around in shoes he'd planned to buy. Ricky Gervais's original The Office was set in the much-mocked city of Slough, and in that tradition, the Slough House series is partly a workplace comedy whose employees do jobs they don't care about, spend hours getting on each other's nerves, and earn nothing but contempt from their boss. Heron makes all his slow horses vivid, from egomaniacal tech whiz Roddy Ho, who everyone hates, to idealistic River Cartwright, whose granddad was a legendary spook, to proper Catherine Standish, a now-sober alcoholic who had once been MI5's Miss Moneypenny, then drank her status away. At a larger level, Heron's plots deftly reflect the immoral lunacy of our current history, from terror attacks on malls to a certain member of the royal family partying, inappropriately. This latest book is set in a post-Brexit UK, and the subjects it weaves together could hardly be more timely. News outlets that manufacture slanted news, Russian assassinations on British soil, attempts to privatize the intelligence service, and rich politicians tricking populist mobs into advancing their personal agendas. Each of these topics is worthy of a Le Carré novel, yet Heron's tone is not remotely Le Carré's. He comes from a later generation, one that finds the world of espionage more comic than tragic. Indeed, one of the underlying themes of the Slough House books is that the intelligence services, like modern politics, have declined to the point of travesty. These days, the slicksters around MI5 are all about jockeying for power. They follow what Heron calls London rules, whose key dictum is, cover your backside. Ironically, the grand exception is the egregiously offensive Jackson Lamb, whose scuzzy Falstaffian manner masks the brilliance of a George Smiley. Lamb was a spy back when you played by what he calls Moscow rules. Watch your back, or you and your agents will be dead. Although Lamb sneers at his slow horses, they're his slow horses, and that means he's responsible for them. The last remnant of British spying's glory days, Lamb may be a bullying slob, but he has an old-school sense of honor.
John Powers reviewed Slough House by Mick Heron. On tomorrow's show, we speak with the founder of Bellingcat, an international collection of people who've become digital detectives, using the internet and social media to help solve crimes, report from war zones, and separate facts from fake news. In conjunction with NBC News, Bellingcat just broke a story about the woman who stole Nancy Pelosi's laptop on January 6th. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, and Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.